Today's episode is part two of our conversation with Tanya Locott. Here she goes into more detail about her research, along with her co-authors Alessio Cornia and Anastasia Deliguri, into how the EU is depicted in Irish media between July 2021 and March 2022, with a particular focus on Brexit and Ukraine. Could we talk in more detail now about Brexit and your findings in relation to Brexit? And I remember where things stood in late 2021, early 2022. Boris Johnson was still Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, and the UK had left the EU, and they had also the transition period, post-Brexit transition, had come to an end. But there was still really fraught relations between the EU and the UK, and a lot of it had to do with Ireland. So this is before the Windsor Framework. The Windsor Framework, which was agreed by Rishi Sunak, sort of brought a little bit more kind of normalization to the relations. But at the time, in that you're talking about, the United Kingdom was still threatening to break international law and basically break the treaty as it had been agreed between the EU and the UK in the withdrawal agreement and the trade and cooperation agreement. So Ireland was still very much kind of fighting for its own position and dependent upon the European Union to hold the line against kind of a lawless prime minister in the United Kingdom who wanted to kind of go back on an agreement that he had already made. So that's the context of the period that you're talking about when in the Irish media, when people are talking about Brexit. You want to say a bit about that?
Yeah, I think it's very clear that during the time that we were collecting our data, we had this very clear sense that there were several dominant discourses in Irish media about Brexit and the EU and UK-Ireland relationships. And they were all kind of really pointing at exactly what you just described, right? So there was one discourse which was more kind of like a discourse of recognition, you know, that Brexit has been extremely disruptive to everyone, to Ireland, to the UK, and to other EU member states, right? So a lot of the coverage was focusing on basically like assessing the damage, and just being very critical of how uncaring the UK was being in terms of, you know, really, as you say, trying basically to pretend like the treaty didn't matter and that they could just break the law left and right. At the same time, there was another dominant discourse that was very complementary of the EU. And this discourse can be summarized as a kind of that the EU has handled Brexit negotiations with care and generosity. And here we see this juxtaposition between the EU and the UK, where, you know, the EU was trying to be constructive, was trying to uphold the norms of the law, but at the same time was very supportive and adamant of being supportive of not just EU interests overall, but of the Irish interests in particular, not just economic ones. Whereas the UK was the exact opposite, right? It was either misrepresenting the economic fallout or just, you know, pretending like everybody else's interest didn't really matter and it was all about the UK. And then there was a third discourse that was quite interesting, which I think at that point still kind of expressed some concern about how well the EU would protect Irish sovereign interests, and in particular, but also the issue of the Northern Ireland Protocol and the border and the peace process as a whole. But at the same time, we saw some very, again, very supportive, especially from the Irish political elites and the ruling parties in particular, very complimentary language, again, about the EU's attention and care to these issues, right? So while some people in the Irish media, including obviously Irish politicians and Irish kind of political pundits, commentators, were saying, let's not forget that this isn't just about the economy, this isn't just about trade, this is also about what's going to happen to the peace process, what's going to happen to the island, right? Because this is a shared island, no matter what happens to the EU's departure. And then also, right, and a series of quotes that we can see and that basically say, look, the EU is actually paying attention to these issues, some of which was obviously because Irish politicians took time to actually, go around EU offices and talk to all of the people who were involved in making the decisions, and basically giving them history lectures, like explaining to them, this is what's at stake here. This is why we need you to pay attention to this. And I think the good thing, as evident from the discourses, is that the EU seems to have listened and it seems to have taken notes. And so what we see continuously is this reappearing theme of solidarity between Brussels and Dublin, where they're very much aligned in terms of the understanding of how important preserving the peace process and, the resolving the issues of the protocol and border issues are to Ireland, not just in terms of economic impacts, but also in terms of the kind of the peace on the island of Ireland. So we see, like, for example, this is a quote from the Irish Times from July, I think, 2021, where this is very much an example of a discourse of solidarity and unity, but also the kind of mutual benefit relationship between Ireland and the EU that we talked about earlier. So here's the quote: Brussels and Dublin have reacted calmly to the British proposals, taking time to study them before offering a response. But when the time comes, they should leave Johnson in no doubt that he must fulfill the commitments he made in the protocol and that it will not be renegotiated. Right? So there's this very clear, like, well, the EU and Ireland are the civilized ones in this discourse, but they're also not leaving the UK under any illusion that, they're in the right and that the UK should actually stick to the promises that it made. And I think that's very telling kind of the overall discourse about Brexit. So I, to me, that kind of really is this example of where we talk about how Ireland kind of reconciles, this EU support and solidarity with that preservation of sovereignty and the focus on the issues that are important to Ireland as a sovereign state.
Yes, that's fascinating, and the I remember that well, and it's interesting that the EU's the because the UK was at times so hysterical, maybe that's an unfair word to use, but at least well, irrational, and they and were basically were being obstructionist for its own sake, almost. In order, they were trying. It was a different kind of performance, right? It was a performance of obstruction for the, and a lot of that is just for the right wing papers, right? Basically, and the EU and Irish kind of response was always one of kind of just calm, rather than not rising to the bait. And Ireland was not Ireland elite opinion was not demanding that the EU start jumping up and down and reacting in anger to the UK's provocations. The EU the Ireland understood that the EU knew that they knew what they were doing, and they knew the right way to kind of approach the UK, and and turned out to be right, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. So to me, it seems like really what, the kind of performance that the Ireland and the EU were putting on in a public arena was like, we're the adults in the room, right? Like we all understand we have this mutual agreement about the things that are important, but we also know that we should be acting calmly and rationally. And obviously, I think, that was, well, maybe not easy to do, but it was certainly easier to do, given that the other side was acting, in this very, very irrational and kind of rash manner, and also that there was no continuous narrative because the people on the stage kept changing, and there were all these internal sort of conflicts. So I think in a way, like that only kind of provided extra assistance to the EU and Ireland.
Okay, if you'll permit me, could I also ask a question about COVID-19? So obviously, the COVID, the pandemic broke out in early 2020, and by mid 2021, it was still raging, though the vaccine was becoming available, and so things were largely improving. What was Irish opinion about the way about the EU as it relates to COVID-19?
Again, I think here we actually saw this example of, well, this was also a crisis, but I think in the EU's handling of kind of the initial reaction and the establishment of, the vaccine provision and all of those things, it's interesting again that the EU as a whole was seen in a very positive light. In the sense of how quickly, it reacted, how quickly vaccines were made available to populations in EU states, and just the overall kind of provision of assistance and coordination between EU countries as well. And it's interesting that even if there were some signs of discontent in either media coverage or maybe later in public opinion, those were more aimed at, again, the national authorities, and in terms of, and I think in Ireland this was partially because, well, the healthcare system was already under stress, so when it doesn't perform as expected, or that there are some COVID-related breakdowns or issues, then it's usually like the blame is not put on the EU. The blame is put on the Irish government or those running the healthcare service. And even in terms of like, restrictive measures, for instance, during COVID, again, those didn't feature as dominantly in our media data because obviously it's been some time and they were kind of on their way out. But I've been reading some of the other research. It's very clear that, mostly like if people were unhappy about the restrictions or the travel stuff, they mostly blame the Irish government and not necessarily the EU, whereas the EU was seen kind of as responsible for the broader response and support. So again, we see this crisis in particular as an example of one where the EU is actually seen as a very constructive and positive actor. So in very pragmatic terms, predominantly by the Irish public and the media coverage.
And in relation to provision of the vaccines, is it in Ireland, it's seen as kind of the EU's role was positive in that sense? Because it's quite different in the UK. In the UK, perception is, and this is largely erroneous, but the perception is that they wouldn't have been able to develop the vaccine as quickly as they did if they were still in the European Union. Which actually is not true, but that's the perception. And whereas that's not the case in Ireland, I presume.
No, I mean, like I said, I think, in Ireland, I mean, again, there was fairly limited media coverage of COVID-19, though there was some, but it was overwhelmingly positive. And I think the coordination between EU states and actually the availability of multiple types of vaccines was actually seen as a boon. It's like, this is why it's a good idea to be an EU member, because There was again this solidarity, and yes, maybe it took a little longer to certify and everything, but there was kind of due process, and then everybody got the vaccines in the end. So I don't d there wasn't anything particularly critical. Like any criticism, if ever there was, at least in our data, which is obviously not covering the whole COVID period, might have applied to like travel restrictions or like supports for businesses, et cetera, et cetera. But I think here again, that's mostly, and I think accurately, right, the blame is placed on the Irish government, which, as we know, even now, even though the EU has provided those recovery funds, the Irish government hasn't necessarily used them to the full extent. And I think that's why it's facing a bit of a blowback right now.
Right, and I was going to ask you about the recovery funds because that was a policy innovation on the part of the European Union during the at the height of the pandemic. They decided, okay, we're gonna have this new next generation EU kind of rescue program, I don't know if this came up in your analysis, but does it show up as kind of an important kind of factor in the way the Irish are thinking about the European Union during the period you're talking about?
It showed up, but in a very marginal way. And I think again, that's probably part of the, part of the reason why is, that was kind of seen as part of the bigger picture of the EU as being generally supportive economically. I mean, the austerity crisis was a long time ago, so I think like the EU is seen as providing, extensive economic support and macroeconomic support to EU states. But again, it didn't seem like there was, well, a much, well, again, right, we are looking at media discourses here, so that doesn't necessarily represent public opinion. I think again, the public probably knows a lot less on average about how these mechanisms work. What the public usually sees, right, is what happens with welfare payments? What happens with recovery funds as they're then apportioned by the local government or the national government? And I think there, then, if something does go wrong or if the funds aren't spent in the way they should be, then it's the national government that gets the blame, perhaps rightly, and not so much the EU, because much of the recovery and restoration that happen locally, whether after COVID-19 or after the flooding or whatever, right? This is always interpreted by the public and potentially even discussed by a lot of the media, especially if we're talking about local and regional media, as a national matter, not so much as a EU matter. So perhaps this is, again, kind of a, I guess, an effect of just the public not being potentially super well informed about how these mechanisms work. How do the funds trickle down, how they're distributed?
Yeah, I mean, I must confess that that was a slightly self-interested question on my part, because at the Brexit Institute, we are running a Jean Monnet Centre of Excellence about the recovery program, about the NGEU recovery program called Rebuild. I'm not, and so we're focused very much on that program, but I'm not surprised if the Irish public and media are not focused on that. In any case, we can leave that aside. I just wanted to put in that little
Yeah, and
plug.
I can just point give you kind of as an aside, our Spanish partners, who were also doing media analysis around the same time, actually found a lot more media coverage related to the recovery fund in Spain. But again, while it was much more prominent in the media discourses, that didn't necessarily translate to public opinion, who also didn't see it as an EU issue. They saw it as a national issue, and so they were, the public thought about these funds in terms of what's the government doing, and not so much what is the EU doing.
Right, and maybe I'll insert here a question about your partners, and we can come back and talk about Ukraine at the end. Since you mentioned your Spanish partners, why don't you tell about the whole project and all the different states involved, and where as a multinational project, where you are who your partners are and what they're doing.
Yeah, so as I said, we have seven countries who are our partners. We have predominantly EU countries. So we have Ireland, Spain, Portugal, Belgium, Hungary, Estonia, and then we have Georgia, which is an Eastern Partnership country and is an aspiring to EU accession together with Ukraine and Moldova and a lot of other countries. So we kind of conceptualize this at the outset, as you know, we have some old EU countries, some newer EU countries, and then we have aspiring EU members. And it's also been really interesting to, as we go along, and as you know, as we look at the literature, as we look at the media analysis, as we look at interviews and public opinion surveys, to see, you know, both some similarities, but also some large differences between the countries. Sometimes along very surprising lines, right? Because, you know, obviously, if we know anything about comparative politics or comparative media research, we know, right, that there are similarities in, say, polarization, or lack of political polarization, political and media parallelism in all these countries. But that doesn't necessarily always translate into how that affects perceptions of the EU. So I'll give you just one example. In terms of, for instance, political polarization, right? So, and as opposed to favorable or unfavorable perceptions of the EU. So Ireland is kind of here grouped with us, with Spain, Portugal, and to some extent even Belgium, where as EU members, these countries have kind of gone through you know, similar ups and downs, especially Spain and Portugal, with regards to, say, austerity, but they have retained a very favorable perception of the EU as a whole. And also, to various extents, but the level of political polarization, especially in Ireland, Spain, and Portugal, isn't very high. In Belgium, it's a slightly different story because it's a special case. You know, it has these different histories of governance and polarization and kind of political party, which side they fall on. But at the same time, you know, there is this dominant kind of very pro-EU set of attitudes on the part of the elites, however grudgingly, and also on the part of the public. In Hungary and Estonia, the situation is very different, but also for different reasons, right? Estonia is obviously a newer EU member, but it has also faced those continued challenges that come from being Russia's neighbor and, you know, Russian influence. And it also has had a growing evidence of political polarization in terms of like the right and far right parties coming in, which actually isn't that different from what we see happening in a lot of older EU countries as well, like France or Italy, or even Germany. And Hungary, of course, is again a slightly different case because yes, there is political polarization, but there is also quite a lot of evidence of like state capture of independent media. And actually, you know, Hungary is the one or one of the few EU countries that has been causing trouble for EU solidarity and like the making of decisions, in particular with regards to accession of new countries, but also with regards to, say, military support for Ukraine, etc. And obviously there's a lot less support, especially from those on the pro-government side towards EU, which is, you know, a bit ironic. And you could be like, well, if you're so unhappy being a member of the EU, have you considered maybe leaving the EU? But obviously, you know, there's a whole other set of research questions around that. And then we have Georgia, which has historically been, again, due to its proximity to Russia, a lot like Ukraine in that it's aspired to become an EU member, both because of the pragmatic reasons in terms of economic development and democratic values, but also because it's, you know, it's an issue of existential security for the country. And in the past years since Russia's invasion of Georgia in 2008, we've also seen a kind of capture of parts of the Georgian state by pro-Russian forces, where now what is happening, right, is the public really wants to be part of the EU. The president and some opposition parties really want to be part of the EU. But the ruling party, the Georgian Dream, is actually very overtly anti-EU and pro-Russian. And so you would think that, you know, this wonderful, colorful landscape of countries Well, you can see where the differences might stem from in with regards to perceptions of the EU. But what we found, and I think what's been really fascinating, is although even in the media discourses, you can see more anti-EU or EU critical narratives in Georgia, in Hungary, in Estonia. There is one thing that sort of unites all of our countries, and that is despite how they feel about the EU, as a geopolitical actor, whether they think it's a good idea to become part of the EU or have a good relationship with the EU, even if they're not extremely excited about that, they still recognize the EU's normative power. So even if they don't see EU as a necessarily friendly actor, they recognize that the EU has sway on the geopolitical arena. And their decisions, both internally and geopolitically, are very much colored by that. So I think for me, that was one of really the biggest discoveries, kind of, as we started to do our analysis, because we expected there to be just all of these differences that, are along like those political polarized lines. But it turned out that actually, even those that are not particularly excited by the prospects of either EU accession or closer EU integration still recognize that the EU is a quite a powerful actor. And that I think is, hopefully bodes well for the EU and what it can do on the global stage going forward.
Right, and that's a nice segue, speaking of the global stage, to talk about the war in Ukraine. And of course, I presume that, well, obviously, at the time that you started this project, you had no idea that war was going to break out and that Russia would have a full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Or maybe, well, maybe you did know, or you had your suspicions. I mean, obviously Russia had invaded Ukraine years before, but the full-scale invasion came right towards the end of your project. So how did that affect? So you can talk about public opinion in Ireland, and you can, of course, and sorry, and media discourses in Ireland. As it affects public opinion, and you can also talk about the other countries as well.
Yeah, I think I have to make a disclosure here that I'm a Ukrainian myself, so I can't say that I didn't expect, because obviously, as you said, the war actually started back in 2014, and parts of Ukraine have been occupied illegally by Russia since 2014. But I do think that there was quite a lot of doubt on the international stage. I think even among some in Central and Eastern Europe that, Russia would be as brazen as it turned out to be in February 2022. And I think certainly when we were designing our project, which was obviously, back in 2020, 2019, we didn't necessarily anticipate that we would have to talk about this as part of our task to looking at, how media and elites and the public talk about EU and Europeanization. So we would expecting that maybe we would talk about, accession, we would talk about association agreements, all that stuff. But we didn't really expect that conversations about the biggest war in Europe for some time would be occupying a significant chunk of our discourse analysis. And, as you say, for our discourse analysis, which started in mid-2021 and finished in March 2022, it meant that we kind of only really got about 2.5, 3 months worth of media coverage during in the run-up to and during the time of the full-scale invasion. But the amount of discourses that related to either the war directly or to Russia's invasion or to the EU's security and defense policy, or to Ireland's military neutrality and non-alignment, turned out to occupy quite a significant proportion of our data. And I think perhaps that's also, for me, indicative of, how central the EU is to the events of the past 2 years, right? How whereas previously in, between 2014 and 2022, Obviously, there were sanctions, and there was some humanitarian and other assistance and some justice-related issues where some EU countries were involved. The involvement was sort of like, at a distance. And I think even the US, which is traditionally seen as again, a powerful actor, or NATO, they were involved, but they were kind of involved primarily through sanctions and economic measures and other things. And then when the full-scale invasion happened, it was really interesting to see how the EU and the US and the UK all responded in different ways, but how quickly that response began taking shape. And I think that's very evident even in the Irish coverage of these events. Where we see very clearly that I think the Irish media and the Irish political elite were very clear from the very start that the EU has a very important role to play here, and that they need to show public solidarity with Ukraine, and they need to impose even more severe sanctions on Russia, but also that it is one of the cornerstones of the EU that it acts as a guarantor of democratic ideals and peace, not only in the EU, but also around the world. So I think to me, this signifies that this is kind of a public recognition of the rethinking, well, or perhaps the extension of the EU's normative power, but also its security influence and its defense influence. And I think for me that goes hand in hand with those really public conversations we're now seeing in the EU and among EU members, including Ireland, about the rethinking of the EU's role as a security and defense union and not just as an economic union. So really, I think a kind of rethinking of what is the EU's role on the global stage and what do EU members need to be thinking about. At the same time, in Ireland, as we all know, if anybody reads the newspapers, this was also a time, and perhaps slightly later than the start of 2022, when there was also a reigniting of this national debate about Ireland's own role, and Ireland's own idea of military neutrality and non-alignment and the difference between those two concepts, but also Ireland's role as an EU member in all of the different aspects related to the war, from humanitarian aid to migration and supporting refugees and displaced people, from involvement in EU security and defense measures, from all of those things, and the forming of a common EU defense policy. So it's really evident that this issue reignited a lot of the previously simmering conversations and debates, not just about Ireland's own neutrality, but also Ireland's neutrality and its role as an EU member. So there was quite a lot of really interesting stuff for us to dig into in the data.
Well, that's really, really interesting. And before I wrap up, I just want to give you, I mean, you mentioned on a personal note that you are Ukrainian and but you're living in Ireland, and I guess I'm just would ask you to just give some final reflections about where things look from where you sit as a Ukrainian in Ireland right now, today.
Well, I mean, I think that to me, and obviously, like it's getting increasingly difficult to separate like the personal and the sort of like the research side. But I think it's very clear that both on in terms of the elites and in terms of the public, I think predominantly in Ireland and also in the EU as a whole, there is still quite a lot of support for Ukraine. There is a clear recognition that, Ukraine is fighting an existential war, that Ukraine's values are much closer aligned with the EU. And so, however long the process of accession might take, it is sort of a no-brainer that, Ukraine's place is in the EU. And I think there's quite a lot of evidence in our analysis as well for this. I think at the same time, The war, and I think maybe the scale of the war, but also the threat posed by Russian aggression and its illegal activity in Ukraine, has also become much more keenly understood by other EU member states. And I think perhaps for Ireland, there is a bit more of a historical connection with Ukraine, because I think it understands on a, the Irish people understand on a visceral level what it is like to be attacked by your big neighbor, who is a bully and who is telling you that your country isn't real and that your language doesn't exist, right? I don't like you say that, and they're like, oh yes, I know exactly what you're talking about. So it's very interesting that I think those historical parallels and that visceral internalized understanding of this war also being a colonial war very explicitly, I think has helped translate Ukraine's concerns for Ireland. And maybe, not for all other EU states, but certainly for Ireland, this doesn't need any more explanation. And I think that it's also very clear from our analysis and from my own kind of, reading the media and listening to Irish politicians and public, that there is a huge sense of solidarity from the EU, from Ireland with Ukraine. But it also requires more pragmatic decisions about the EU's own security and defense policy for the long term, and also Ireland's security and defense thinking as part of the EU, as a sovereign state that gets to decide how it conducts itself on both the political and military kind of decision-making fronts. But that this needs to be happening now, not just in relation to the things that will happen in the next year and the kinds of support that Ukraine might need, but as a more long-term strategy, because it is clear that threats are there, they need to be considered, and Ireland and the EU need to be thinking about what's our long-term approach, what are the decisions we should make that will allow us to protect our sovereignty and to protect our democratic values, but also to protect the EU and the values that it stands for in the long term.
Well, I think that that's an insightful and actually quite profound note to end on. And so I guess there's nothing left for me to do but just to thank you, Tania Locott, for your time today, for a really fascinating discussion about your research. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ian. It was a pleasure to be speaking with you.
You've been listening to Decades, made with the support of the Irish Department of Foreign Affairs Communicating Europe Initiative, although the views of the guests are entirely their own. The Post-Brexit Europe podcast is a product of the DCU Brexit Institute. The host is Ian Cooper. The producer is Lucrezia Rossi. Music by Doug Romano. Thank you for listening.